Discourse on Habeas Corpus by Gary Hunt, Outpost of Freedom, Episode 8, Chicanery, Deceit, and Circumvention. So now after the 14th Amendment, we've got two classes of people, those that are subject to federal jurisdiction by virtue of their citizenship being granted by the 14th Amendment and the afforded protections, and those who are not, like Twining and his buddy Cornell. This creates kind of an interesting scenario because, hey, in a sense, the government has assumed an authority outside of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, and Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2, where they can extend their jurisdiction, but it's rather unique how they extend that jurisdiction. There was a case in 1936 that begins to give us a little insight. Now, it'll refer, I won't be in the discussion, but it referred back to some cases in the early 1900s where the court was beginning to implement an approach to certain decisions that didn't have a basis in the Constitution. Rather, it had a basis in finding a way of deciding the case otherwise. So what we've got, and the background of this case doesn't really matter. The circumstances of this case don't matter so much as something that Justice Brandeis gave in a separate concurring decision. Brandeis wanted to let us know how the court was acting in these, to explain something away. He agreed with the decision, but he had to set a distinction, clarify the relationship of the court and its decisions with regard to the Constitution. The case, 1936, Ashwander versus Tennessee Valley Authority. It's at 297 U.S. 288. That's 297 U.S. 288. So Brandeis told us this: the court developed for its own governance in the cases confessedly within its jurisdiction a series of rules under which it has avoided passing upon a large part of all the constitutional questions pressed upon it for decision. They are, now let me interrupt here, confessedly within its jurisdiction. That's kind of an interesting, didn't say within its jurisdiction, he said confessedly. So confession to jurisdiction perhaps is an element, I'm not quite sure. Anyway, number one, the court will not pass upon the constitutionality of legislation in a friendly, non-adversary proceeding, declining because to decide such a question is legitimate only in the last resort. So if it's a non-adversary proceeding, they're not going to decide on it because the It's legitimate only in the last resort, and that'll be clarified later. Number two, the court will not anticipate a question of constitutional law in advance of the necessity of deciding it. It is not the habit of the court to decide questions of a constitutional nature unless absolutely necessary to a decision of the case. Let me go back over that. The court will not anticipate a question of constitutional law in advance of the necessity of deciding it unless absolutely necessary to a decision of the case. Ah. The court will not formulate a rule of constitutional law broader than is required by the precise facts to which it is to be applied. That's number three. So they're going to, if they do make a constitutional ruling, they're going to make it as narrow as possible. Number four, the court will not pass upon a constitutional question, although properly presented by the record, if there is also some other ground upon which the case may be disposed of. This rule has found varied application. Thus, if a case can be decided on either of two grounds, one involving a constitutional question, the other a question of statutory construction or general law, the court will decide only the latter. So they're not going to rule on a constitutional question, although properly presented by the record, if there's also present some other ground upon which the case may be disposed of, and that other grounds is statutory construction or general law. Number five, the court will not pass upon the validity of a statute upon complaint of one who fails to show that he is injured by its operation. Among the many applications of this rule, none is more striking than the denial of the right of challenge to one who lacks a personal or property right. Thus, the challenge of a public official interested only in the performance of his official duty will not be entertained. Now, that's fascinating. The court will not pass upon the validity of a statute upon complaint of one who fails to show that he is injured by its operation. Excuse me. And then he points out that a public official interested only in the performance of his official duty will not be entertained. So let's see. If we had a Nazi prison guard at a camp, and he said, this camp is unconstitutional, our court would have told him, you don't have standing. You can't raise that question because you're not injured by its operation. You've got your job, you're getting paid. It's kind of scary if you think about that until you're injured, you cannot seek a constitutional or statutory remedy. I guess I should have said a statutory remedy because we're dealing with the statutes. Six, the court will not pass upon the constitutionality of a statute at the instance of one who has availed himself of its benefits. The court will not pass upon the constitutionality of a statute at the instance of one who has availed themselves of his benefits. So let's see, if I go to the government agency and ask for a benefit, once I accept that benefit or even ask for it, I'm bound by all the statutes encompassing that particular benefit. That's once you avail yourself to the benefits, you have kicked the Constitution out the door with regard to your constitutional rights. Now that's a kicker. Do you know if you abiding by a statute or seeking a benefit by a statute that you're saying, go away, Constitution, you don't matter anymore? And finally, he says, number seven, when the validity of an act of Congress is drawn in question, and even if a serious doubt of constitutionality is raised, it is a cardinal principle that this court will first ascertain whether a construction of the statute is fairly possible by which the question, that's the question of constitutionality, may be avoided. I'm going to read that one again. When the validity of an act of Congress is drawn in question, and even if a serious doubt of constitutionality is raised, it is a cardinal principle that this court will first ascertain whether a construction of the statute is fairly possible by which the constitutional question may be avoided. So what's all this reference to statutes? If statutes, going back to all the cases we've discussed before, if they have to have a constitutional nexus, how come the construction of the statute becomes the element of determination without regard to the Constitution? Unless the government is assuming an exclusive jurisdiction in certain cases. And in those certain cases, absent you're objecting timely, you're being thrown in the group called 14th Amendment citizen because that relationship is created by your citizenship of the United States created by 14th Amendment, which Corning and Twining did not have. Cornell and Twining did not have. Now, administrative agencies existed prior to this Ashwander versus TVA decision. But as you'll see when we get into the discussion of the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946, that we're going to find that very few people were affected by the administrative agencies. And this is coming from the congressional record of the proceedings discussing, and this is a congressional record, March 12, 1946, the year of the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946 was enacted. This is Pat McCurran, a Democrat from Nevada, talking, and he was the sponsor of the bill. And he says, we have set up a fourth order in a tripartite plan of government, which was initiated by the founding fathers of our democracy. They set up the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branches. But since that time, we have set up a fourth dimension, if I may so term it, which is now popularly known as administrative in nature. So we have legislative, the executive, the judicial, and the administrative. Four branches of government. Bet you never knew that. Perhaps there are reasons for that arrangement. We found that the legislative branch, although it might enact a law, could not very well administer it. So the legislative branch enunciated the legal precepts and ordained that commissions or groups should be established by the executive branch with power to promulgate rules and regulations. These rules and regulations are the very thing that impinge upon, curb, or permit the citizen who is touched by the law, who is touched by the law, as every citizen of this democracy is. Oh, well, he's going to change the picture on that in a minute. Senate Bill 7, the purpose of which is to improve the administration of justice by prescribing fair administrative procedure, is a bill of rights for the hundreds of thousands of Americans whose affairs are controlled or regulated in one way or another by agencies of the federal government. It is designed to provide guarantees of due process in administrative procedure. Now, he said the hundreds of thousands of Americans whose affairs are controlled or regulated in one way or another by agencies of the federal government. I find that rather interesting. Let's say it's 900,000, less than a million. In 1946, the population of this country was 150 million people. So we're talking about less than 1% of the people in this country, according to that sentence, but the previous one, or permit the citizen who is touched by law, as every citizen of this democracy is. So the administrative procedure appears to be apply to that less than 1%. He goes on, the subject of the administrative law and procedure is not expressly mentioned in the Constitution, and there is no recognizable body of such law as there is for courts in the judicial code. Well, does that mean there's no constitutional nexus, as we discussed in the cases before? Or does that mean that it's not there because now we've got people that are either in Washington, D.C. or in the territories, or let's say if you were a citizen in Washington, D.C. or one of these territories, or hey, a slave that didn't have right to citizenship, that if you have citizenship, it's based upon the 14th Amendment, not upon the Constitution itself. He continues, problems of administrative law and procedure has been increased and aggravated by the continued growth of the government, particularly in the executive branch. Now that is scary. Problems of administrative law and procedure have been increased and aggravated by the continued growth of the government, particularly in the executive branch. Now this is 1946. This is 67, 68 years ago. And he's talking about the growth of the executive branch of government that now touches all of our lives 24 hours a day, no matter what we do, what toilets we can flush, what light bulbs we can use to light our house. However, the question arises, is that distinction that I've talked about valid? Can we test the constitutionality of a law by habeas corpus? Now, the Supreme Court said only in certain circumstances, and so we'll be addressing that in the next discussion episode.